This is 88.3 Southern FM. The next national radio news will be tomorrow morning. But in a few moments, the astronomy news will be on. This is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented at this time every week by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on Mission Control tonight we have Alan Walker and David Fletcher. Now, on tonight's Space Show, well, with Mars making its closest approach to the Earth next week, what else could we do but devote the show largely to the Red Planet? We're going to hear from Robert Zubrin of the Mars Society, and he's going to set out the case for the human exploration of Mars. Tony Phillips will be in with an icy story or two about Mars, and the folks at Earth and Sky fill us in with the facts about the approach of Mars. And there's also a new theory around about how the Martian moons might have formed. Plus, we have astronomy news. So why don't we kick off with Space Show Astronomy News. In a seesaw effort to determine whether mid-sized black holes exist, astronomers recently announced more fresh evidence that they do. Scientists agree on two common black hole types. Stellar black holes contain the mass of a few suns and likely result from the collapse of very massive stars. Supermassive black holes anchor most large galaxies and can harbor masses equal to millions or even billions of stars. Now, middleweight black holes, thought to be a few hundred to a few thousand times the mass of the sun, have been hard to pin down. Each time one group has thought it had strong evidence for one in recent years, another group has found an apparent hole, if you excuse the pun, in the thinking, or have come up with fresh observations to discount the previous study. The latest evidence comes from a team led by John Miller of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Using the European Space Agency's XMM Newton satellite, the scientists measured the temperature of hot gas near a suspected black hole. And that's gas that might be preparing to take its final plunge beyond the abyss. That's a sphere of no return for matter and even light. Now, astronomers find black holes by noting their effects on surrounding matter. As gas spirals in toward a black hole, it is accelerated to a significant fraction of the speed of light and superheated, giving off radiation that researchers monitor. The new X-ray observations were combined with optical data on two objects embedded in the spiral galaxy called NGC 1313. Now, NG-1313 is about 10 million light-years away from us. Theory predicts that the temperature of gas spiraling into a black hole will be hotter with smaller black holes. Perhaps because of the tighter orbit it is forced to track along. Now, Miller and his colleagues found temperatures consistent with black holes containing at least 100 times the mass of the sun. That's likely to be 200 to 500 solar masses. Says John Miller, evidence is mounting that these elusive intermediate black holes may really exist. And he added, the mystery really is how they can exist. Now, theorists suggest that middleweight black holes might form via mergers of smaller black holes, or, in the early universe, explosions of the more massive stars that existed back then might have generated black holes 100 or more times the mass of the Sun. Now, these hefty black holes might have served as building blocks for the supermassive variety, those that anchor galaxies, but theorists have not pinned any of this down. In other astronomy news, a highly sensitive telescope designed to detect exotic gravitational waves is now online and hunting for evidence of catastrophic events such as collapsed stars and collisions between huge black holes. The Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, otherwise known as LIGO, L-I-G-O, has begun its initial search phase. Now, Einstein's general theory of relativity predicts that concentrations of mass or energy warp space-time, what he considered to be the fabric of the universe. Now, significant rapid changes in the shape and concentration of mass or energy should unleash distortions that move outward at the speed of light, much like the ripples on a pond when a stone is thrown in it. The gravitational waves are not electromagnetic energy. The radiation, which, of course, we're emanating here from 88.7 FM, for example, is electromagnetic, and so too is light and X-rays, and even gamma rays, which come from the nuclei of atoms or from its stellar interiors. These are targets for conventional telescopes. But gravitational waves are said to be similar to light waves in some respects, in that they too propagate through space at different frequencies, but all much weaker than electromagnetic waves. They are weaker because the fundamental force of gravity is weaker than the fundamental electric force or electromagnetic force. The LIGO team reported this week that it has not ramped up to full sensitivity and so has not yet detected gravitational waves. But early observations conducted in September last year put new constraints on the phenomena and show that the instruments are working as designed. Now, among the quarry of the LIGO will be pairs of dense neutron stars bound in orbit around one another. Now, neutron stars are the collapsed remnants of regular stars that can pack the mass of the Sun into a ball just a few kilometres wide. In fact, you could pack the whole mass of the Sun into about the size of Melbourne. Now, Einstein's theory holds that two neutron stars in close orbit should disrupt space-time significantly. Now, one pair of neutron stars was found in the 1970s to lose energy at a rate consistent to dissipation by gravitational waves. However, they didn't at that time weren't able to detect the waves. Now, LIGO will sense gravitational waves by shining a laser light onto a detector. Now, as ripples pass by, the light beam should be slightly perturbed. By noting different frequencies in the waves, astronomers expect to learn about the source of a disturbance. Now, LIGO uses the disturbance between its detectors, situated in Louisiana and Washington State, to confirm that any recorded events indeed involve the passage of gravitational waves and not the same local event. Now, if LIGO works, its first accomplishment will be to prove that gravitational waves are more than theoretical. Then, scientists hope, it will help them explore details of cosmic events that are largely or wholly invisible to other telescopes. Well, you've been listening to the astronomy news here on The Space Show.
This is Earth and Sky. When the Voyager 2 spacecraft visited Uranus in 1986, it saw a beautiful but almost featureless planet.
Then in 1994, astronomer Heidi Hamel of the Space Sciences Research Institute happened to see a Hubble Space Telescope image of Uranus.
And they got some pictures of Uranus that showed these bright clouds on it. And I asked the people, what are these pictures of Uranus that show these clouds? And they said, oh, that's just what Uranus looks like. I said, well, no, that's not what Uranus looks like. Uranus doesn't have any bright clouds like that.
Voyager visited Uranus in its northern hemisphere winter. Now Uranus has moved in its 84-year orbit around the Sun. Its northern hemisphere spring equinox is due in 2007. There are more clouds in the atmosphere of Uranus, and bands encircling the planet are changing in size and brightness as sunlight strikes parts of the planet for the first time in over two decades.
It just goes to show you that in science, you don't always know what you think you know, and sometimes you get surprised. And it's following up on those surprising things that really makes science interesting.
Hamill now wants to see if parts of Uranus that were shrouded in darkness will develop more active weather after a few years of sunlight. That's our show. Our thanks today to the RGK Foundation of Austin, Texas, celebrating women in science. We're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky.
St. John's Ambulance is a charitable organization that's been active in Australia for over 100 years. When a crisis occurs anywhere around the country, St. John's volunteers are there to help. They know that every second counts. They are ordinary people doing extraordinary things in their local communities. People with a commitment to practical and compassionate caring. Become a St. John's volunteer so you too can help save lives. Call St. John toll-free on 1300-360-455 for details.
This is Earth and Sky on oxygen and where it came from.
Each breath of air you inhale is made up of 20% of the gas essential for animal life, what chemists call O2, free oxygen.
20% is a fortunate amount of oxygen. It's plenty for our respiration. But if the concentration of oxygen were greater than 30%, Earth would be a world where fires would be impossible to extinguish. With less than 12% oxygen, fires wouldn't burn.
Our atmosphere hasn't always been in this perfect balance. Until 2.5 billion years ago, there was little free oxygen. The change in atmospheric composition began as tiny marine organisms evolved the ability to use carbon dioxide, water, and sunlight to make food, photosynthesis, whose byproduct is oxygen. Oxygen was also released into the air as the ocean's water molecules separated into oxygen and hydrogen.
Scientists estimate that by about 400 million years ago, enough oxygen had accumulated for the evolution of air-breathing land animals. Meanwhile, a special kind of oxygen was also building up at the top of Earth's atmosphere, O3, or ozone, which shields us from harmful solar radiation.
That's our show. Special thanks today to the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Foundation, a private foundation dedicated to advancing research and education in the chemical sciences. We're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky.
And you're here on the Space Show, and we're only 1 week away from that close approach. Yes, just a thought here, that Neanderthals, you know, the ancient form of humankind that disappeared from our planet, apparently pushed out by the modern humans, Homo sapiens. Well, did you know that Neanderthals, according to the information that's coming in at the moment, have been closer to Mars than any human has? Yes, closer to Mars than any human has. Well, how did that happen? Well, Mars has a rather strange orbit. Well, it's not really strange, it's just simply elliptical, which means it's closer to the Sun at times and further away at other times. And so has the Earth, also got an elliptical path. And there is just a happy coincidence that every few years we come a bit closer to Mars than usual. And that's what's happening this year. And apparently it's going to be the closest for many, many thousands of years, but not by much. And we'll hear more about that later. Anyway, let's kick off our program tonight about Mars with a little bit of the music written by Vangelis for the 2001 Mars Odyssey mission. Here's part of Methodia.
Thank you.
and some of the splendid music by Vangelis. Mythodea is composed to celebrate the NASA spacecraft, the 2001 Mars Odyssey, which in turn was named in honour of Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And that craft, of course, is now firmly in Martian orbit and has been returning some splendid results. And we at the moment have a number of other spacecraft on the way towards the Red Planet. They're due to arrive in December and January. And we've been covering them on the Space Show. Now, Mars is the fourth rock out from the Sun. It's a terrestrial rocky planet, a lot smaller than the Earth, bigger than our Moon, but it's got a gravity, if you were stood on the surface, of about one-third. And it has two moons. Now, these two moons, called Phobos and Deimos, have always been thought to be captured asteroids, but a recent report suggests that they could be the product of the breakup of a huge moon that once circled the Red Planet. The capture of a large Martian satellite may have taken place during or shortly after the formation of the planet, with Phobos and Deimos now the surviving remnants. The origin of the two moons presents a long-standing puzzle to which one researcher proposed the new solution at the recent International Conference on Mars. According to Fred Singer of the University of Virginia's Science and Environmental Policy Project in Arlington, Virginia, nobody has been able to explain the origin of Phobos and Deimos. Based on research performed as a visiting scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston in October last year, Singer said that conventional hypotheses about the moons either violate physical laws or have difficulty accounting for their observed orbits. Well, Singer reported at the meeting that there are no ready alternatives to explain the origin of the Martian moons. Now, at present, both satellites have near-circular and near-equatorial orbits. Phobos's orbit, however, has been observed to shrink since its discovery in 1877. The present track of Deimos, which is just beyond the synchronous limit, where it nearly matches the spin rate of Mars, is an important data point. Singer says, is that an accident? And he says he doesn't think so, and he thinks it gives a clue about its origin. Now, through a complex set of orbital calculations involving Mars, the large hypothetical Mars moon itself, and tracking back in time the past and present whereabouts of Phobos and Deimos, Singer believes he has a case. In the Singer scenario, the close proximity of a large original moon to the Red Planet, captured in Mars' synchronous orbit, would have eventually fractured the object. Gravitational pushes and tugs would have turned it into a rubble pile that would still cling together gravitationally. He said that forces would soon drive the largest pieces into Mars, with the smallest pieces remaining as Phobos and Deimos. Now, in the breakup process, the most massive pieces would spiral in far more rapidly, crashing into the planet. And he says that we need to look for some sign that these existed. Now, a fundamental prediction by Singer is that the moons are similar in composition and petrology. However, Phobos and Deimos do not appear to be comparable. That distinction is obvious in looking at the differences in their regoliths, that is, each moon's topside covering of soil. Now, Singer said that we need both surface... that we need both surface and deep samples to decide on this issue and to investigate whether Phobos and Deimos once formed as parts of a larger body, most of which has now disappeared, perhaps by impacting on Mars. Now, Singer said that Phobos will die in a few million years. In a sense, he said, we're lucky. We're seeing Mars while it's still around. Now, Singer himself has plans for Deimos. The scientist believes the moon would serve as a natural space station for future human explorers. Singer said that, first of all, humans on the surface of Mars cannot really do the exploration directly. They have to use rovers to get around, and to go from the equator to the pole on Mars just takes too long. It's a big and dangerous journey. Now, what Singer envisions is a Deimos gateway to extensive Mars exploration. An encampment of astronauts would reside on the Martian moon. From there, dozens of rovers could be autopiloted in real time. He said there would be no time delay, or it would be so short that it's within human reaction time. And from Deimos, quick down to the surface, sorties could be undertaken by humans to selected areas. He also added that this would be a 15-year project as I look at it. It would cost roughly $30 billion, that's American dollars by the way, funded at some $2 billion a year on average. And he said that that's well within NASA's existing budget. Well, of course, on the political side, Congress is not likely to fund a long series of robotic roving probes to Mars that extends over decades. But Singer said well, that would not be a very efficient way of studying Mars. If you want to solve a really big problem on Mars, like the origin of life, you need to do this in one fell swoop. By the way, the traditional idea of the origin of the moons of Mars is that they are captured asteroids, and they certainly do look like asteroids from the photographs that we have taken of them. And you're listening to a Space Show special on 88.3 Solon FM, celebrating the close approach of Mars to the Earth in this coming week. And we're going to hear from Tony Phillips. He does the science at NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. And he reckons that Mars is melting. Well, sort of. Subliming, really. But anyway, he's got the details.
It's not every day you get to watch a planetary ice cap melt, but this month you can. All you need are clear skies, a backyard telescope, and a sky map leading to Mars. Actually, you won't need the sky map because Mars is so bright and easy to find. Just look south between midnight and dawn on any clear night this month. Mars is that eye-catching, rusty red star, outshining everything around it. It's getting brighter every night as Earth and Mars converge for a close encounter on August 27. Mars has gotten so big in recent weeks that even a backyard telescope will show details on the planet's surface. Dust clouds, volcanic terrains, impact basins. Best of all is the polar ice cap. The southern hemisphere of Mars is tipped toward Earth, and its bright southern cap, which reflects more sunlight than any other part of the planet, is remarkably easy to see. Don't wait too long to look, though, because the ice is melting. Like Earth, Mars has seasons that cause its polar caps to wax and wane. It's late spring at the south pole of Mars. The polar cap is receding now because the sun is shining on it, explains planetary scientist Dave Smith of the Goddard Space Flight Center. Southern summer on Mars begins December 29th, he says. By then, much of the polar cap will be gone. Watching the polar cap disappear is fun. The shrinking cap develops rifts, dark spots, and a ragged border. Lately, for instance, amateur astronomers using 8-inch and larger telescopes have been watching a frosty mountain range emerge from the ice. Says Smith, these are the Mountains of Mitchell, named after the Ohio astronomer who first spotted them 150 years ago. A bold dark rift called Remus Australis cuts through the polar ice just south of those mountains. These features are visible in Thomas Williamson's photograph of Mars at the beginning of this story. Something else to look for is the cryptic region, a dark zone hundreds of kilometers wide. Even after the ice above it recedes, the cryptic region remains remarkably cold, according to infrared cameras on board NASA's Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft. No one is sure what the cryptic region is, but it's probably big enough to see from Earth, notes Smith. Here's an amazing fact. The seasonal polar caps are made of Martian air, mostly carbon dioxide, or CO2, that freezes during winter. Depending on the time of year, more than a quarter of the Martian atmosphere can be found lying on the ground around the poles. As seasons come and go, this carbon dioxide shifts back and forth, lying on the ground during cold months, floating through the air during warmer months. The worldwide air pressure rises and falls by 25%. For comparison, the air pressure inside a hurricane on Earth is often only a few percent lower than ambient. You can experience a full 25% difference in pressure by traveling from sea level to the top of a 9,000-foot mountain. Just try running a 100-yard dash up there. The South Polar Cap is vaporizing now, which means CO2 is rushing back into the atmosphere. Remember, though, adds Smith, there are two polar caps on Mars, North and South. While the South Polar Cap is vaporizing, the North Polar Cap is growing. It's a balancing act. Overall, air pressure will be greatest when there's the least amount of carbon dioxide on the ground. The next such peak is due in early October, that is, early southern summer on Mars. The boost in pressure has some interesting consequences. It won't make the Martian atmosphere thick by Earth standards. At best, the air pressure on Mars is about 100 times less than on Earth. But it might become thick enough in some places for liquid water to flow. Liquid water is normally impossible on Mars because the air pressure is so low. On a warm summer day, ice doesn't melt, it vaporizes. But a small boost in pressure could be enough to allow water to flow under a warm summer sun. Southern summer, therefore, might be a good time for future human explorers to visit. On the other hand, thicker air also encourages dust storms, which are a big problem on Mars. Small dust clouds stirred by sun-warmed winds sometimes grow to encircle the entire planet. In 2001, such a storm lasted for months and frustrated astronomers who couldn't see through the haze. Will that happen again this year? No one knows. When the seasonal polar cap finally vanishes, Smith recommends looking for the permanent polar cap. The permanent polar cap, he explains, is made of frozen water hiding beneath the seasonal cap of carbon dioxide. While the seasonal cap is wide-ranging, 90 degrees to 60 degrees in latitude, and shallow, only about 1 meter deep, the permanent cap is compact and about 3 kilometers deep. It harbors a mass of water comparable to the mass of the Martian moon Phobos. To amateur astronomers peering through telescopes, the water ice cap will look like a tight white knot within 10 degrees latitude of the pole. Dark, cryptic spots, mountainous rifts, a treasure trove of water. There's a lot to look for around the South Pole of Mars. Grab a telescope and see for yourself. Editor's note. In this story we talk about the Martian polar caps melting or vaporizing. That's not exactly right. A physicist would say more accurately, the polar caps are subliming. In other words, the frozen CO2, better known as dry ice, transforms directly from a solid to a gas without going through an intermediate liquid phase. This story was written and read by Tony Phillips and presented by Science at NASA. To find more Science at NASA stories on the Internet, please visit science.nasa.gov.
Special on the approach of Mars, the opposition of Mars coming up in a few days' time, is going to continue after this message here on 88.3 Southern FM. Now, we'll just hear a little bit more of Vangelis, shall we, just in the meantime.
Medical breakthroughs have meant new uses for blood products, and our aging population means more cancer and orthopedic work which requires blood. Bone marrow and organ transplants, more common now than ever, use huge amounts of blood. Yet only about 4% of people eligible to donate blood actually do so. According to the Australian Red Cross Blood Service Victoria, if this figure could be increased by just 1%, Victoria could have a substantial blood supply. Please help maintain the blood supply and become a blood donor today. For more details about donating blood and your nearest collection centre, call 131495. 131495. I've been giving for the last 47 years.
The Space Show is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia, which is a non-profit and non-political group of space enthusiasts, and we're keen to share with you and others the excitement of space exploration. Now, if you'd like some more information about the association, then why don't you drop us a line? The address is Space Association of Australia, Post Office Box 351, Mulgrave North, postcode is 3170. So that's box 351, and the postcode is 3170. It's in Mulgrave North. And there will be no meeting. We normally hold public meetings, free public meetings every month, but this month there will be no public meeting this month. So the next one will be next month, and we'll tell you about that in a future space show. Right now we've got another station announcement, and then we're coming back to our special on Mars.
25 years ago, Life Be In It sent a wake-up call to Australia. Being active can be fun, it said. But not only fun. Being active also makes you healthier and happier. Everybody got the message. Or almost everybody. But 25 years on, there are people out there who seem to have forgotten the Life Be In It message. Or weren't around in the first place. So maybe it's time for another wake-up call.
Be in it. Today, live more of your life.
And now we continue our special on Mars. Now, as we said at the beginning of our special on Mars, that Mars is going to be the closest to us for a good long time. And the folks at Earth and Sky have the details on this event.
This is Earth and Sky, Tuesday, August 26. Earth will pass between the Sun and the planet Mars on Thursday of this week.
According to astronomers' calculations, Mars will be slightly closer to Earth tomorrow than it's been in 59,619 years. Its closest point will come in late morning tomorrow in London, shortly before dawn Central Daylight Time in the U.S. Mars will be within 35 million miles, or 56 million kilometers.
Early skywatchers couldn't calculate these distances, but they knew that Mars gets particularly bright every 15 years. I remember the close approach of Mars in 1988. Mars will be only a hair closer this year than it was in 1971. Now we know these times of special brightness happen when we go between the Sun and Mars, while Mars is closest to the Sun in its orbit. We'll go between Mars and the Sun on Thursday. Mars will be closest to the Sun next on Saturday.
Tomorrow's is the first of a handful of close passes between Earth and Mars between now and the year 3000. The next one closer than this year's will come in the year 2287. Mars is now a blazing red light from sunset till dawn. By the way, for charts showing its location, come to earthsky.org. Thanks today to Research Corporation, a foundation for the advancement of science. We're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky.
And now we're going to hear from Dr. Robert Zubrin. He's the founder of the Mars Society, which is a worldwide organisation. It has a chapter here in Australia called the Mars Society Australia. And he visited Melbourne and spoke at Story Hall at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. And he put the case for exploring Mars. And of course, we're talking about human exploration of Mars here. So our thanks to Mars Society Australia for bringing him here, and here's what we recorded.
We're going to be on Mars for a year and a half. Okay, that's the plan. 6 months out, year and a half surface, 6 months back. You got to be on Mars for a year and a half if you want the planet to line up right for a low energy shot right back to Earth. Okay, now what are we going to do in a year and a half on Mars? We're going to explore. Now we're going to explore Mars to find out all kinds of things. There's all sorts of things people want to know about Mars, that people want to do seismometry and meteorology and all sorts of stuff and be able to write papers in fancy journals. But there's two fundamental sets of questions about Mars that make it of pressing interest, not merely to the academic scientific community, but to the human race at large. Okay? The first of those sets of questions revolves around the issues of, was there or is there life on Mars? Okay? All of you, unless you were on Mars yourself in the summer of 1996, should have heard about the Allen Hills meteorite, you know, which is a piece of material that was ejected from Mars by impact from another body and which flew through space over some millions of years and then landed on Earth 16,000 years ago and was found in Antarctica in 1983 and then promptly lost in the vaults of the United States government. They put it, you know, where they put the lost ark, and so they lost it. But then they found it again in 1993, and it was finally subjected to scientific examination. And in 1996, the team that did the work surfaced with their findings and presented evidence as to that this rock showed for bacteria being active in it on Mars 3.5 billion years ago. Now, this evidence is actually inconclusive, okay? Which does not mean that it's insubstantial, but it's not conclusive by any means. And there are different teams of people arguing about it and bombing each other with adversarial papers, refuting and debunking each other even as we speak. So that's by no means a settled affair. However, putting the Allen Hills meteorite aside altogether, long before that thing showed up, Mars was a suspect for life. And the reason why Mars was and is a suspect for life is because we have found places on Mars where life could have been. Lots of places. Okay? We have imaged on Mars water erosion features in great abundance. Okay? That is, there are no canals on Mars. Okay? No canals. No. Okay, those are illusions of 19th century astronomers. But there really are dry riverbeds on Mars. Okay? Here are photographs of dry riverbeds on Mars taken by the Viking orbiters in 1976. And there are dry lake beds on Mars. There even appears to be what looks like the basin of a dried up northern ocean on Mars. And the evidence from imagery such as this, and as well as some other data that we have, strongly supports the contention at this point that Mars had liquid water on its surface for a period of 1 billion years. Now that is 10 times as long as it took Mars to appear in the, 10 times as long as it took for life to appear in the fossil record on Earth after liquid water appeared on this planet. So, if the theory is correct, that the development of life from non-life is a natural occurrence of complexification of chemistry into life wherever you have a water-rich temperate environment for a sufficient period of time, then life should have appeared on Mars, even if it subsequently went extinct, okay, when the conditions on the planet deteriorated. And if we can go to Mars and find incontrovertible fossils of past life on Mars, let alone survivors, which conceivably could still exist deep underground where there may be liquid water still. Okay? What we will have proven is not just, gee, Mars once had bacteria, isn't that neat? No. What we will have proven is that the processes that lead to the development of life from non-life are non-exceptional, that they're highly probable. And since we now know that planetary systems are non-exceptional because we have discovered over 30 of them in nearby interstellar space, we know planets are common. If life develops wherever it has a decent planet, then life is everywhere. And since the entire history of life on Earth is one of development, of evolution, from simple forms to more complex forms, each incorporating greater degrees of capacity for activity and intelligence and exponentially more rapid evolution, okay, then if life is everywhere, it means that intelligent life is almost everywhere. It means we're not alone. It means that intelligent life on Earth is part of a vastly greater phenomena spread throughout the galaxy. We're part of something much bigger than anything we even suspect at this moment. On the other hand, if we go to Mars and we find that, yeah, you know, here's some dry riverbeds and dry lakes and dry ponds and sedimentary rocks and sandstones and all sorts of things like this where we might expect to find fossils, and we find none, okay, then that could argue for a very different position. That could argue that the processes that lead to the development of life involve a most miraculous freak occurrence of improbable combination of atoms into these highly complex DNA molecules, you know, which like 10 to the 176 chance that it'll never happen in the life of the universe. It could mean we're completely alone in the whole universe. So either way, it's a question of vast philosophical importance, and it's worth finding out. And in my view, the only way it can be found out is by sending human explorers to Mars. Because, look, there's a lot of things you can do with robots on Mars. For example, one thing you can certainly do is do imagery from orbit. That can definitely be done quite well with robots. Humans are not required. If you want to do meteorology on the surface, you can do that with robots. If you want to do seismometry on the surface, you can probably do that with robots, although it's not demonstrated. But if you want to do fossil hunting, that's a different game altogether. Because fossil hunting requires a much more intimate and complex interaction between the investigator and the environment. I mean, fossil hunting on Earth requires, you know, hiking long distances through unimproved terrain. It requires climbing up steep hillsides or other kinds of difficult terrain. It requires doing heavy, heavy work like digging and pickaxe work. It requires doing delicate work like carefully splitting open fossil shales edgewise to reveal the pages of fossils that have been pasted between these pages of rock of a book. You know, fossil shales. You ever have a favorite book drop in the toilet and all the pages get pasted together and now you gotta split them apart with a knife without destroying the ink so you can still read it? I have. You know, I mean, this is delicate work, and this is what the kind of thing you have to do. This is way beyond the capability of robotic rovers. You know, you take the little Sojourner. Sojourner is wonderful. I love Sojourner. I like things like that. They're really good. And it was the first thing that could move on Mars at all. But Sojourner could move 6 feet a day. Okay? It could not climb over a rock more than 12 centimeters high. Okay? Its eyes were positioned about 16 centimeters off the ground. It had no manipulative abilities whatsoever. Okay? You know, I live in Colorado, which is dinosaur heaven. I don't know if you know this, but all the dinosaurs used to go to Colorado to die. And treasure troves of dinosaur fossils have been found in Colorado. Okay? And but I could guarantee you that you could parachute 1,000 Sojourners into the Rocky Mountains and you would never find a dinosaur fossil. Okay. Never is a long time, but in fact the search would be cut off by the advancing glaciers of the next ice age, which would crush this army of Sojourners because they would not be able to outrun the glaciers. Now, if you want to do fossil hunting, you've got to have real live human rock hounds on the scene. Okay. So the crew is going to be on Mars for a year and a half, and at the end of that time they get in the Earth return vehicle. They start it up, and they shoot home direct to Earth. They leave behind on Mars the habitat, the reactor, the pressurized rover, the greenhouse, the light truck, the solar panels. Is that bad, leaving all this stuff behind on Mars? No, we don't need to bring it back to Earth. We have a lot of stuff here already as it is. Okay, the idea of Mars missions is to bring as much stuff to Mars as you can and come back with as little as you can. Okay, because everything you leave behind on Mars becomes available for future missions. So, for example, here's the situation that would emerge on Mars after 8 missions have occurred. And by the way, this chart should convince anyone, even the most skeptical person, of the practical value of this plan. Because what you can see here is that after 8 missions have occurred, we will be able to relocate Texas to Mars. I rest my case. The No, actually, that is an exaggerated claim. Texas is just here for scale. And you can see that Mars is much bigger than Texas. So these are the different landing sites. The landing sites are at the centers of these circles. And these circles have a radius of 500 kilometers, which is the sortie range of the ground vehicle. And they have they're separated from each other by 800 kilometers. So you could drive from one base to the next. That's less than your one-way driving range. So, for instance, if you're over here in mission number 7 in a totally uninteresting place like Texas, you could get into your rover and drive over here to base number 6, which is in New Mexico, which is a lot more fun, and continue to explore there, or even go to Arizona or California. But in any case, what we're doing here is we're opening up contiguous human terra cognita on Mars on a pretty significant scale. But after a certain number of these missions have occurred, and I don't know whether that number is 8 or 6 or 10, but it's something like that, the questions about Mars are going to shift, because we're going to have the answer to question number 1. We're going to know whether there was ever life on Mars, and we're going to have a pretty fair idea as to the characteristic forms it managed to develop itself into. And that being the case, the central question about Mars is going to shift. I mentioned there were 2 fundamental sets of questions about Mars, and the second is going to come to the fore. And that second question is an even more important question. And that question is not, was there or is there life on Mars? The second question, the most important question about Mars, is, will there be life on Mars? Because, look, the most important fact you need to know about Mars is this. That Mars is not just an object of scientific inquiry. It is that. It is an extremely important object of scientific inquiry. It is the Rosetta Stone for letting us know whether life is unique to the Earth or a general phenomenon in the universe. But Mars is more than that. What Mars is a world. That's what Mars is. It is a planet with a surface area equal to all the continents of the Earth put together, and which has on it all the resources needed to support life, and therefore, potentially, someday, a new branch of human civilization. And if we can go to Mars and learn how to use these resources that do exist on Mars, okay, then we can make Mars habitable. Now, what do I mean by make Mars habitable? Do I mean terraform the planet, you know, like in Star Trek II, The Search for Spock, transform the planet into a lush green place covered with forests and meadows and skylarks and butterflies and squirrels and flying fish? Yes. Okay. That is what I mean. Okay. And I believe that humans will do that on Mars someday. Someday. Okay. And the reason why I believe that humans will do that on Mars someday, it is because we are life. And it is the nature of life to take barren environments and transform them into those that are friendly to the development and propagation of life. That is the entire history of life on Earth. Life has radically transformed the Earth in the interest of life. It is life that put oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. There was no oxygen in Earth's atmosphere before the presence of life. Life created oxygen. It is life that put soil on the continents. And it is cooperative ecologies of plants and animals working as communities together that have colonized those continents, starting from the shorelines, working in the plains, up the hills, and the mountains, as high up as life can go, they go. And no sooner does some barren place appear on the Earth, you know, like Hawaii coming out of the Pacific Ocean is this big island of basalt, then birds fly over and drop seeds, and plants grow, and then Polynesians show up and let loose pigs, and then Europeans show up and build hotels. You know, this is what we do. Okay, this is what we do. And it would be unnatural if humans, as the kind of bird that the biosphere has evolved that is capable of flying across the interplanetary ocean and depositing the seeds of life on other worlds currently barren out there, new islands in interplanetary space, did not do exactly that. So that is what we will do someday. But that is not what we will do, we who are alive today, we who are in this lecture hall today. No, that unfortunately is beyond our time. Nevertheless, we, the people of the present, can have the honor of making Mars habitable by transforming it in a different sense, not physically, but intellectually. Okay? Because, see, look, what defines whether an environment is habitable or not? It's only partially a function of the objective nature of the environment itself. It's also largely a function of you, of your own intellectual apparatus, of what you have in your mind. Put it this way. Are the woods habitable? Well, to who? Okay? Two people can be stranded in the woods, and one can starve to death in 3 weeks, and the other could live there indefinitely in relative comfort. And what's the difference? To one, the resources of the woods are invisible, and to the other, they are apparent. So similarly, if we can go to Mars and learn how to use the resources which exist on Mars, which include abundant water frozen into the soil as permafrost and ice yet, but there, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the nitrogen which exists on Mars, the sulfur, the calcium, the phosphorus, then all the iron and titanium and aluminum, and the mineral ore which has been created per force because Mars has had a complex geologic history of water action and volcanism, which is what you need to create mineral ore. If we can take these objective circumstances that exist on Mars and turn them into useful objects, okay, if we can learn how to grow crops in Martian soil with water that we've extracted from the Martian soil, or better yet, geothermally heated water that we've gotten from deep underground, which would give us both lots of water and also some power. If we can learn how to make bricks on Mars, if we can learn how to make ceramics, glasses, plastics, metals, wires, tubes, habitation structures, if we can develop that craft, okay, Mars craft, then we have made Mars into a place that humans can settle. Then we have opened up a new world to humanity, which someday that branch of humanity will actually physically transform Mars. Okay? So we can do that. Now, exploration can be conveniently be done by small groups of people operating out of very limited facilities scattered widely across the surface of Mars. But engineering research of the type that I've just described needs more people, it needs more power, it needs more tools, it needs a substantial division of labor, it needs a real base. Okay? How do we create a real base? Well, during the previous period of exploration, at the same time we're looking for life, we're also prospecting the place to identify the best place to concentrate a substantial human presence on Mars, to pick out a place to put the base. And within that region, favorable resources and other factors, we find a place that's locally trafficable. And then we just start landing a lot of habitat modules all at that place. Now, you'd like to have the habitats mated together so people could visit each other without having to get all dressed up all the time. Okay? And it'd be kind of dicey coming down on rocket engines, you know, with 2 feet of clearance. Bad idea. Okay? So you'd have to land them several hundred meters apart and then move them together. Now, there's a number of ways you could do that. You could just land them apart and then jack them up one leg at a time and attach a wheel to each leg and then a cable and a windlass to the cab and roll them together and mate them up, and that would work. But another way to do it would be to have second-generation habitats whose landing gear can articulate not only up and down, but also side to side. And since the habitats have 6 legs, this would allow the habitats to walk, much as the Martians did in the War of the Worlds. And since that technique actually has some heritage on Mars, that is what is depicted here. Thank you.
And applause there for Dr. Robert Zubrin, the founder of the Mars Society, and we recorded that at Story Hall at RMIT right here in Melbourne. And our thanks to Mars Society Australia for bringing him to Australia. Well, that concludes our special on the approach of Mars, and we'll be back next week at just after 7 o'clock news. A big thank you to Alan Walker and David Fletcher for doing panel tonight, and I'm Andrew Rennie, and we'll be back next week.